Welcome to the July 29, 2015, 9:30 YPO/WPO Global Diplomacy, Public Policy, and Peace Action Networks. The Game of Camps, Episode 1, Nuclear Deal, Israel's View in a Shifting Region, Practitioner View Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Joe Gantz. Please begin.
Good day, everybody. I'm Joe Gantz from the New York Metro chapter. I'm going to moderate this morning's call. We're fortunate to have Dr. Ernan Lehrman as our resource. But before introducing Dr. Lehrman, a couple of administrative details. This will be about a one-hour call. The first 25 to 30 minutes will be turned over to Dr. Lehrman. When he finishes up, he'll let us know, and then we can open it for questions for the balance of the call. The call is being recorded, and an archive link will be posted on the Global Diplomacy and Public Policy page on Exchange. And finally, this call is the first in five of a series of global conference calls presenting insider viewpoints on various regions throughout the world. As the stage is open for all to discuss and share, we will provide a view from one side of a region on each call, allowing members to provide an alternative, diverse, balanced perspective on successive calls. Please be reminded that YPO's mandate is to remain non-political. As we all know, the Middle East is going through a tectonic shift. Israel has not been directly impacted, but is an active participant. Colonel, retired Dr. Lehrman has been in the eye of the storm. And let me give you a little brief history about Dr. Lehrman. He's the Deputy for Foreign Policy and International Affairs at the National Security Council in the Israeli Prime Minister's Office. He served as an assistant for analysis to the Deputy Director for Intelligence Production at the IDF. He's been active as a lecturer in political science at Haifa. He holds a BA in history from Tel Aviv, a PhD from the University of London, and an MPA from Kennedy School of Harvard. That impressive background, let me turn over to Dr. Lehrman to educate us.
Joe, thank you, and I also want to thank Yariv Cohen for making this possible. In a sense, it's a pity to ruin a perfectly nice and warm summer morning with a briefing on these subjects, but you asked for it, so here I am. And the truth is, we are truly in the eye of the storm of a very fierce debate on the Iranian question, but that debate in and of itself, more clearly in the last few months than has been the case before, is framed by the broader landscape unfolding around us of regional turmoil. I know that the media still likes to call this by a nice and cuddly, flowery and seasonal name, namely the Arab Spring, but I increasingly call this the mother of all misnomers. The reality is that as a result of, as Joe rightly called it, this tectonic event, ongoing earthquake that has broken up the landscape all around us. What we see is a transformative period extending well into the foreseeable future in which not only politics but countries as such are reshaped and in some cases torn asunder and broken beyond repair. We've been through a previous earthquake of this sort in the late 80s, early 90s, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cold War system broke down, and with it much of the political and strategic landscape that we were familiar with for a generation. Countries like the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen vanished and merged with its nearest neighbor. The Palestinians and the Syrians, who were Soviet clients, ended up at an American negotiating table. Saddam Hussein tried to rob a bank by invading his neighbor. All of these were sort of aftershocks, but the epicenter of that earthquake was up north in Moscow, where the Soviet Union collapsed. This time it came from within, for the very heart of the region. It began in the periphery in Tunisia, but spread very quickly to the streets of Egypt. We saw this in Tahrir Square. And soon enough, the entire landscape changed. And as we try here in Israel, and I'm speaking as an Israeli practitioner and scholar, if I may say, as we try to navigate this landscape, we need a compass. And increasingly we find that the traditional geopolitical tools of analysis, what they call the realist school of international affairs, you know, Henry Kissinger's effort to educate the American people away from soft Wilsonian idealism and into the hard world of raison d'etat, all of this is very important, but what do you do about raison d'etat where there is no etat, when the states have vanished or broken up or have been hijacked by forces which do not answer to state authority? Libya has broken into myriad pieces, not only the Fezzan and Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, but also tribal and local and feudal groups and gangs, and by now also elements of the IS, affiliated terrorist organizations. Egypt has gone through a convulsion, but at least it's now under a unified hand. But, for example, its relations with Turkey have gone overnight from friendly to almost from friendliness to the verge of enmity. And certainly the geopolitics did not change. The ideology, the political imperatives changed. Further afield, Syria has disintegrated beyond repair. Iraq is broken in three irretrievable pieces, Kurdish, Sunni, and Shia. And I could go on. Lebanon has long ago been hijacked by a terrorist organization which is far stronger than the state itself, namely Hezbollah, on behalf of Iran. And the Palestinians are divided right down the middle between the legitimate governance in Ramallah, which remains our negotiating partner, although they refuse to come to the table, and the Gaza Strip under the control of the Muslim Brotherhood on Palestine, better known as Hamas. So all of this leads us to a conclusion that if we need a tool of analysis, we need a compass, the only way to find it is by organizing the region in according to its politically and ideologically oriented groupings or camps. So I use the term the Game of Camps, with obvious reference to the Game of Thrones, but very few blondes and no dragons, but otherwise, in terms of the scope of butchery and the sheer bloody-mindedness of some of the players, the similarities are striking. And we are looking at a region which, very briefly, I will describe as being divided now between four warring camps. I'm saying four, not six, because the old socialist nationalists, the Ba'athists, the Nasserites, the secular nationalists of Syria, of Egypt, of Iraq, have been cast on the ash heap of history, as the phrase used to go, because their link to the Soviet Union meant that they basically perished as a political force. At the other end of the spectrum, the liberals, the pro-Western, open-minded, open-eyed young men and women whom we saw at Tahrir Square at the early stages of the upheaval have basically failed in every place but one, the sole exception being Tunisia, to gain any sort of hold on practical political power. And even in Tunisia, they are there only because they have struck an effective alliance with the conservative forces. So four camps, three of them belonging to what I would call not Islam as a religion, but a version, or to be precise, a perversion of religion, modern totalitarian Islamism. Another infamous misnomer in my mind is calling these people fundamentalists. They have very little to do with the fundamentals of Islam, and a lot to do, as many people have already written, for example, Paul Berman in Terror and Liberalism, a lot to do with the template of political action we know as modern totalitarianism, the Nazi version, the fascist version, the Soviet or Bolshevik version. The Islamist parties modeled themselves after these totalitarian forces in the 20s, 30s, and 40s of the previous century, and have basically created a model of politics which one brave Egyptian called in Arabic, Shumuliyah Elatit Atamasah Bidin, in other words, totalitarianism masquerading as religion. This is what we have in Iran and with Iran's allies and proxies. This is what we have with the Islamic State, the so-called caliphate of the man who calls himself Baghdadi. His real name is Ibrahim Samarai, but he calls himself Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to claim the caliphate, to claim the inheritance of the Muslim world. And it is also the case with the more sophisticated, more westernized variant of the same subject, which we know as the Muslim Brotherhood and its various sister and daughter parties. So these three groupings are in all of them, as the Prime Minister here once called it, branches from the same poisonous tree. But they are also bitterly divided, sometimes murderously divided, and engaged in a fight to the finish, one against the other, for control of the region and its future. The fourth camp is the camp of which I will call the forces of stability, those who want to stand up against the challenge posed by the former three and try to sustain what I would call a pro-Western, sober foreign policy and domestic policy. This is the essence of the struggle, and this is what makes the question of whether or not Iran would end up being empowered as a, even well before sunset clause sets in and they can rush forward with the production of fissile material which could be used for a bomb, which will happen in 10 years under the agreement. There's also the question of what will they do with the immense flow of funds that would come from the lifting of sanctions, which then that is scheduled to happen right away. And we are not alone in Israel in being very worried, very, very worried about this aspect of the new situation. Because Iran, unlike, for example, North Korea, is not isolated, is not an island of weak economic and industrial capabilities in a verdant region, as North Korea is isolated among its neighbors. Iran is a potential powerhouse, 85 million people, a strong industrial base, and a very ambitious political agenda driven by ideologies, Islamist, Shia, revolutionary ideology. And what makes this very relevant and acutely central to the current debate is the fact that they are actually on the march. They're not in retreat. They're not weakened by recent events. They are very much an aggressive power on the march. And they have allies. They are, in effect, the rulers of Lebanon through the overwhelming military capability of Hezbollah, which, as I said, hijacked the state of Lebanon and is much stronger than the central government. They are present in Gaza, both through their alliance with Hamas, which works with Iran, and through their control of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a smaller but equally deadly terrorist organization, which is a fully owned Iranian proxy. If Hamas works with the Iranians, PIJ works for the Iranians, but the effect is much the same. And the capability of the terrorist organizations in Gaza to relaunch the kind of war as they did this summer against Israel is very much dependent on the flow of Iranian arms, training, money, and the drive provided by Iranian pressure. Further afield, in Syria, the Assad regime is a totally, it may not be even Muslim, really. The Alawites are a sect that has left the fold of Islam hundreds of years ago. But he is very much an Iranian ally, almost proxy, totally dependent on Iranian support. In Iraq, the Abadi government, and before that even more so the Maliki government, was very much under Iranian influence, And just recently we saw that when they launched the campaign against IS, they didn't do it in the name of Iraqi nationalism. They did this in the name of Shia affiliations. So clearly, again, the Iranian influence was predominant and will continue to be predominant with all the heroic efforts being made by the coalition to resurrect some kind of a unified Iraq. What triggered an even greater level of concern, and here I'm really speaking not for Israel alone, but for very large parts of the region, certainly most, if not all, of the Gulf states, was what happened in Yemen. This may be very remote and very far and very different from the landscape we live in, but Yemen may be the back door, the back entrance to the holy places in Saudi Arabia. And much as the U.S. looked upon communist forces taking hold in Central America in the 1980s, for the Saudis to see the Houthi uprising backed by Iran, supported by Iranian weapons and money, even if the Zaydis in Yemen are a different kind of Shia from the Iranian Shia, but at the end it doesn't matter. I can certainly tell you that the flights on a daily basis now from Tehran to Sana'a are not carrying curious Iranian tourists. So the Houthi uprising rounds up a situation in which the Iranian leadership brags, not Rouhani and Zarif, these nice smiling faces, the real people in power, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, or known as the Pasdaran in Persian, they are actually saying that under Khamenei, Iran has now spread to the shores of the Mediterranean and to the straits of Bab el-Mandeb at the entrance to the Red Sea, crucial waterways for the international economic trade. And they are now masters of four Arab countries, four Arab capitals, Beirut, Damascus, Baghdad and Sana'a in Yemen. So we have to look upon Iran. And we from our perspective, not only Iran itself, but the Iranian camp in Syria and the Golan Heights in particular, in Lebanon and in Gaza on our border, we have to look upon Iran as an ambitious and vicious in regional and international player with strong ambitions to change the global disposition that has been pertaining since 1945. I know that some people have been comparing in their minds this deal with Iran to the project in Cuba. But to be blunt, the difference between Iran, the Iranian case and the Cuban case is like the difference between taking a half-dead communist horse to the knacker's yard and trying to tame a man-eating tiger. These are very, very different practical propositions, and to assume that the success of one tells you anything about the prospects of success in the other is to misread the essence of the situation. But having said all this about Iran and the meaning of the Iranian deal, this doesn't mean that we ignore or underestimate the threat posed by the Islamic State, which is a dynamic and dangerous and demented force in regional politics. It's just that we, at the end of the day, have to weigh very carefully what our priorities must be. And clearly, Iran and its camp are far more dangerous and far more active, even than the IS, for all the ugly and almost and the murderous and almost incomprehensible headlines that IS provides us with. It is a dynamic force. It is spreading both through conquest in Iraq and Syria and through the acts of allegiance, or bay'ah in Arabic, in places like Libya and northern Sinai and so on. But I can also say that wherever IS met with resolute resistance, like, for example, the Kurdish forces, men and women, standing against them in the streets of Kobani in northern Syria, then they did rather less well than they did than what happened when they were raiding or invading disgruntled Sunni areas where the hatred of the previous government was so strong that they were willing to try anything. And so IS is dangerous. It must be fought. It must be confronted. But it cannot be compared in the sense of the magnitude of the danger to what Iran would pose, even now, certainly, once they cross the threshold into a semi-official nuclear status. And I would say also that Israel, of course, cannot join the coalition against IS in any direct way. This would only serve to validate these mad bastards in terms of here we are fighting the Zionists for you. But indirectly, through our support, our strategic support for our neighbors, and I don't think I should elaborate much further, but certainly Jordan is very central to this struggle. We provide indirectly the strategic envelopes that enable our neighbors to turn their face and fight IS in an effective way. So we are not neutral in this game. We certainly want to help anyone who needs help in this fight. The only thing we are asking is not to subordinate the very real challenge posed by Iran to this significant challenge posed by IS. The order of priority has to remain sober and in place. A third challenge comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a more sophisticated operation. So it's, they know how to use parliamentary elections. They know how to wait. They know how to play a complex political game. So they're less. They're not that easy to corner and denigrate the way we look at other Islamist phenomena. But at the end of the day, when you read their documents, when you take the Hamas covenant in hand, and you know, Google is a verb in English nowadays, take it and look it up, or Google it at the Yale Avalon Project text, and you'll see a vile, Nazi-inspired document that explains all of modern history through the lens of Jewish iniquities. And this is the Muslim Brotherhood. The Hamas is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. And unfortunately, the two important regional players are very close to the Muslim Brotherhood in their orientation. Turkey under Erdogan. The AK party is very much, I would say, if not the brother, then the cousin of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Qatar, which for various reasons is standing diagonally to the positions of the rest of the Gulf states and has been supportive of Hamas in particular and the Muslim Brotherhood in general, including President Morsi when he was still in power in Egypt. And the Qatari position is in this respect a very jarring and problematic position in the struggle for stability in the region. Now, let me finish by saying, and open this, Joe, open this up back to questions and queries, by saying that against all three, there is clearly a camp of a significant group of forces willing to stand up, determined to prevent the spread of these political forces and terrorist forces in the region. And I would say that Israel is part and parcel of this group, of this camp. Even the definition of the region is changing. I'm no longer sure we should speak about the Middle East. In any case, this is a British colonial relic, like the term they still use at the State Department, the Near East. It's not very near, quite frankly, from an American point of view. And in any case, it's a British... These are both British colonial references. The proper term, as far as we are concerned, where are we in the world? We are in the Eastern Mediterranean. Our Prime Minister just visited Cyprus. The Foreign Minister of Greece came here the day after the Greek referendum on the European package. The Prime Minister of Italy has just visited. The President of Croatia, the Lady President of Croatia, has just been here. All of these are Mediterranean players, and our affinities with Egypt and with other stability forces in the region around us is increasingly, I would say, defined and driven by Mediterranean imperatives. The Mediterranean could also become the crossing for immigration and for terrorists and for others driven by the violence in the Arab world. And so increasingly this is our frame of reference, and within this frame of reference there are enough forces that are willing to join hands against the challengers. And to this you should add the Saudis, the UAE, others in the Gulf, with whom we have a coherent point of view that we share. And I would have loved to see the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah join. And in some ways, we do have the same perspective. We all reacted to certain developments in a very similar way, like the fall of the Muslim Brotherhood regime in Egypt was welcomed in both Jerusalem and Ramallah with the same spirit. I would say, however, that since they seem to be unable to come to terms with our most basic positions on in the negotiations, in terms of the American framework for negotiations, the need for them to recognize that we are a legitimate national movement, the need for them to recognize that our security proposals, our security positions are important for them as well as for us. As long as they resist these notions, it's very difficult to move forward in a way which would be beneficial for all of us in the region. But at least we are making a serious effort at the bottom-up level, at the economic and security cooperation level, to keep this under a certain level or manageable level of tension. So it doesn't spill over and undo the larger effort to unify the like-minded forces in this part of the world. So much for for my initial briefing, and let's open this for Q&A.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lehrman. I'm sure there are lots of questions, but let me take as the moderator the first one. You talked a little bit about Syria and the fact that it's a failed state. From the Israeli point of view, what's the end game in Syria?
Well, there is no Syria anymore, and I very much doubt if there will be. I don't think Assad can take the rest of the country under any circumstances. I don't think IS can conquer the 30% now held by the government, which have 30% of the territory, 70% of the people, many, if not most of them, do not belong to the Sunni faith and would fiercely resist a genocidal conquest by Baghdadi and his hordes. So there is a sort of reality setting in that Syria is by now broken, like the legendary statement by Julius Caesar about the Gallic Wars. It's all broken in three parts, and by now it's irretrievable. The Kurdish north will go its own way. The rump state of the regime of the minorities and the secular Sunnis in western Syria will consolidate in one way or the other, and the question is, how do you pull them from under the Iranian thumb and over into more positive directions? And the Sunni areas will, for the time being, may well be consolidated under IS rule, but IS is fragile, it's not invincible, and sooner or later something else will replace them in the new geopolitical space that has opened up in eastern Syria and western Iraq. It's the same story in Iraq. The Kurdish state in northern Iraq is on a trajectory to independence. I don't think that they are polite enough and wise enough not to contradict American policy, not to assert their claims too early and unnecessarily. But I think no one that knows the situation on the ground has any doubt that they will not come back under Baghdad's rule under any circumstances. So federation, confederation, or independence, the reality on the ground is already and will certainly be in the future a reality of Kurdish independence. And also, and further south, the Shia and the Sunnis are so bitterly divided now that I doubt very much that the state of Iraq will have any meaning in the future.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to, at this point, ask the operator to give instructions of four questions. We have a couple in the queue already. I would just remind people to please ask questions, don't make speeches. Operator?
Thank you. To ask a question, please press star 1. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off so that we may receive your signal. If you wish to ask a question via the webcast, please click the Ask a Question button.
I think we have one question here in New York. Do we have Dick Simons? Are you on in New York?
Yeah, I'm not in New York, but yet am I on? Can you hear me?
You are on. Go for it.
Okay, great. No, I'm actually from the WPO New England chapter, and I'm currently calling in from Lamu, Kenya. But anyway. So thank you very, very much for insightful analysis. I guess I'm trying to understand. You used the term early on, real politics, and focusing on Iran, the status quo seems like it isn't working. And you laid out four different countries that Iranian proxies are either in control of or largely control of, and you're months away from breakout capability of Iran having nuclear weapons. So I guess my question is, from a real politics standpoint, when you see a situation that isn't working, do you take a look at that and go, all right, well, as an adversary, this has been very unsuccessful, and just concern what happens if America's Congress ends up shooting down the proposed agreement and our allies, non-Israeli allies, our the other P5, want a treaty, at which point we no longer have the leverage of sanctions and Iran presumably racing to get nuclear capability and that much more antagonistic toward the West and toward American interests.
Well, I don't know how far. Let me make four quick points. I don't know how much more antagonistic you can be than sending millions of people in the streets shouting death to America. So maybe by saying terrible death to America, but that's about as far as antagonistic as it can get already. So I wonder whether much has been done to reduce real antagonism. Again, not in the smiling faces of Rouhani and Zarif, who mean absolutely nothing in the real power game in Tehran, but in the eyes of Ali Khamenei, who has modified his positions not one iota. The second point is, it's not that we did nothing in the face of this 1 month away. We issued a certain warning of sorts on the 20%, and they actually turned back the 20%. And then what was built was a very formidable system of sanctions. That system of sanctions was greatly enhanced in the last few months by the fact that the Saudis, quite deliberately, against the background of the situation in Yemen, used the one weapon which they use effectively, and unfortunately the Air Force isn't one. But the spigot is very much an effective Saudi weapon, and they used it to effect. And oil prices, to the relief of 95% of the human race, Putin and the fracking industries not included, came down to $50 a barrel. But this was done to break the back of the Iranian economy. So at this point, to offer the Iranians what is clearly an ambiguous and highly problematic, if not worse, proposition, when you could have and were in a position to negotiate a much more robust deal. And this is all we are saying. It is wrong to ascribe to us the position of no deal under any circumstances. Certainly not. The whole idea of the sanction system, which in various ways we helped to create, was to create the necessary leverage for a deal that would keep them away from the bomb. By now, what they have is a legitimized trajectory to a bomb 10 years from now, unless you take them at their word, and I would not suggest doing that, given their record. And then beyond that, what will the allies do? The truth is, the only allies which really matter because at the end of the day, the Iranian economy will not thrive simply on Russian business. And the Chinese will not trade the American economy for the Iranian economy, so they would be very attentive to the American position. The European allies have, one and all, been more hardline, particularly the French, than the American administration in these negotiations. I used to joke, I hope I'm not offending anyone, that this infamous book in America called 50 Reasons to Hate the French should at least be modified by one, because on the Iranian question, they were rock solid. So, but they, of course, there was a limit beyond which they could not undercut the American position. But I do not see a situation where, if this fails in Congress, the French would run to Tehran and say, well, you know, leave the Americans and come with us. That's certainly not their position. They are very much attuned, as others should be, to the position not of Israel. Nobody has ever accused the French of being too attuned to the positions of Israel in the last 50 years, but or to be precise, 45 years. But they are very much attuned to the positions of the Gulf states, the Saudis and the UAE, who say about this Iranian deal every bit as what we say. It came to the point in which Prince Bandar, in an essay published in a Lebanese paper, was basically cribbing the prime minister on the similarities between this and the North Korean diplomatic failure.
Dr. Lehman, we have some other questions, so let me, if I could, just interrupt you so I can get some other questions. We have a question from Nancy Reynolds in Hong Kong. And she asks the question is, what's the best course of action by the Israelis and by other powers in the region if the Iran deal is accepted and approved by all parties?
Well, first of all, we'll have to be extremely vigilant in terms of any infringement of what is already a bad deal and could get much worse if the Iranians begin to cheat. Secondly, there needs to be a very robust enhancement of the capacities of Israel and others in the region to resist Iranian-driven encroachments on our sovereignty and on our security. Let me give you just one example, and it would give you a sense of where we are. Ali Khamenei has posited a doctrine under which the West Bank should be turned into the next Gaza. I'm not sure this should cause much jubilation in the West Bank, but that's his idea of turning this part of the world into a hell for the marauding Jewish invaders. This is a country committed to our destruction, so I am not surprised by his position. But if he is to achieve that goal, then he has to undermine stability in the Kingdom of Jordan, because otherwise there will be no access. The only other access than Israel to the West Bank is through the Jordan Valley. In other words, we need to be very vigilant and very supportive of the Jordanian monarchy, of the Jordanian state and government and people, in resisting this kind of pressure that would come from Iran and from Iran's proxies, Syria and Hezbollah. And this is just one among many examples of what would need to be done across the region to offset the effect of Iran being in once again in possession of huge amounts of money to spend on its political projects.
Okay, very good. William, I think you're in Washington. You have a call. You have a question on the call?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're on.
Can you hear me? Okay. So to come back to this question of what happens if Congress votes this deal down, you know, it seems to me it's somewhat of a fantasy to say that the negotiations will be reopened and somehow drive a better deal. It's easy to say, gee, I could have negotiated a better deal. But the fact is it's already been approved by the UN Security Council. And, you know, every country in Europe is already rushing to reestablish trade relations with Iran. They're having conferences, et cetera. They're doing trade missions already. So the cat is out of the bag. The sanctions will be lifted. And so the question is, would you rather have sanctions lifted and then give Iran the choice of whether or not to follow the deal with the other five countries and honor it, or the choice to simply say, okay, well, we've got the sanctions lifted, the whole thing has fallen apart, we'll just proceed with our nuclear program and thumb our nose at everybody. You know, I think the most likely scenario is they proceed with the other five. It's a slap in the face to the United States, and the rest of the world ignores us and goes forward and holds Iran to the deal without us. That's the most likely scenario. So how in the world is it helpful to give the United States a slap in the face like that?
Well, first of all, to the best, I, of course, I'm not going to sit here in Israel and advise the American people and its representatives on how to go about what should be their business. I will give you our assessment that from our impression, and we have been in constant contact not only with our American counterparts but also with others these last few months and years. Our distinct impression is that the key European players, you know, they call these negotiations the E3+3, plus EU, rather than the P5+1. The three European players, Germany, France, Britain, are not automatically enamored with the prospect of Iran rushing forward. And therefore, if a legitimate vote in the United States Congress tells them that a huge majority of Americans, through their representatives, have rejected this, then what you do, as you do under similar circumstances, is to go back to the table and see what can be renegotiated. And Iran does not have that much of a choice in the matter. We are talking about a country which is very big in regional terms, very potentially dominant in regional terms, but no match to the united will of the international community. And things like this have happened before. There was a situation in which all of us were waiting to see if there will be action on Syria, and the British Parliament decided in the opposite direction to say no. So I would definitely, first of all, I would say that where we sit, we see the American administration and the U.S. Congress as both being the United States in this respect. And the fact that this is not a treaty, and therefore it is not being put forward to a two-third vote in the Senate, doesn't change the fact that at the end, this was always going to be subject to the political dynamics that will test its validity. And we are offering observations on this validity from a professional point of view, because we can see quite a lot of problems, particularly in the verification mechanism. And since as far as we are concerned, this text begins with an Iranian lie, namely that they have no wish to have a bomb. We know they do. In fact, the very size of the project is military and military alone. Then the quality of the verification mechanisms becomes the central question, not the language of the Iranian promise, because it cannot be trusted, but the quality of these mechanisms. And these mechanisms leave a lot to be desired.
Well, thank you very much. We have one final question from Yariv, and then I think we'll wrap it up. And the question Yariv asked is that Turkey is now gearing up to enter the war with Syria. In fact, there was an article in today's Wall Street Journal talking about Syria and Turkey and the positions putting in NATO in because of the Turkish deal with bombing the Kurds. So, what do you think the impact of Turkey entering the conflict with Syria will be, and what are the implications vis-a-vis the Kurds?
Well, quite frankly, if I was confident that the Kurdish issue is the marginal one, and the mobilization against IS, against Daesh, as it's called in Arabic, is the central element, then I would treat this with greater confidence, but it almost strikes me as if the Turks are paying lip service to the war on IS in order to enable them to resume bombing of PKK Kurdish targets. And I doubt very much whether this will make enough of a difference in the balance of power in Syria. If it was otherwise, if they really decided that IS has gone far enough and the world should be rid of this phenomenon, then they could be in Raqqa in D plus seven, as soldiers say. But in addition to a certain degree of reluctance on the part of the Turkish leadership to do so, there's also a problem with the Turkish military, quite frankly, which is signaling to Erdogan that after being, forgive my language, having 12 years in which he was trying to do to them what you do to a male cat if you want to keep it at home, it's not exactly something that the Turkish military is keen to embark upon in the south of their border. So the bombings are one thing. And I am afraid that they seem to be more focused on the PKK than on IS. If they should really change their position on IS beyond the wave of arrests in Turkey, then they can make a difference quickly. They can close the border. They can put an end to training camps and facilities for terrorists in Syria, in Turkey. In the process, they could also throw out the Hamas terrorist infrastructure that's operating from Turkish soil, and they could very quickly make a difference in the balance in the region. I wish I was confident about Erdogan's willingness to do so.
Okay, so even though I said it's one last question, Michael from Manhattan wants to ask you one more question, Dr. Learman. Michael, are you on the phone?
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. The one thing that we'd love to understand a bit more of is, you know, you mentioned a lot about the Hamas, the proxies of Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Of Iran.
But, sorry, of Iran, yeah. But I'm saying in Lebanon and in Gaza. But we haven't spoken at all about what Netanyahu's strategy to be, even despite the fractious government. In the many years since, we've seen all these trends, since pulling out of northern Lebanon, we've seen, so southern Lebanon, I mean, a huge amount of these trenches and tunnels and weapons being put in. What the immediate threats that surround Israel, the tunnels that we saw in last year's war, what is going to be the strategy, and why aren't we seeing any more aggressive action?
Well, the truth is, ever since the establishment of the State of Israel, the central element of our defense concept has been deterrence. We have no wish for war. We would go into a preventive war only if we came to the conclusion that all other options have been exhausted. We may have to do so, but we would rather not. It's our children who would be under fire from Hezbollah rockets, 100,000 rockets now stored in Lebanon, not all of which we can take out in any first days of a conflict. Of course, we are proud of the record of our technological solutions, such as Iron Dome, but at the end of the day, we would rather implement a strategy of deterrence as long as it holds. And in the case of Hezbollah in Lebanon, almost to our surprise, since 2006, by and large, deterrence has been working. And when we had skirmishes, there was a sophisticated mechanism on their side as well as ours to bring them under control and prevent escalation over very short periods of time. And I think deterrence is still working, and maybe even more so now for a simple reason. If Hezbollah gets into a war with us now, it would be hit so hard that it may be fatally weakened, and then Lebanon would be open to conquest and slaughter by IS, who would stop at nothing to get to kill every Shia man, woman, and child they can lay their hands on. So for Hezbollah to risk this at this time of its history, and this could take some years, is quite a formidable undertaking for them. And so the deterrent equation works. deterrence is a very paradoxical animal. It requires you to be much stronger than your enemy, much more sufficiently determined to use your force when necessary, but also clever enough to leave the other side in sufficient level of governance so they can make decisions, sober decisions, in the context of the deterrent equation. This is what we tried to do, and to some extent finally succeeded after 7 long and frustrating weeks in Gaza. And this is what has been holding in Lebanon since the war of the summer of 2006. So we are well into the 9th year since we last had a round with Hezbollah. We are not blind to the danger. We are getting ready on a daily basis. We are developing very sophisticated solutions, as you saw in Iron Dome. Frankly, if anyone in the American in baseball hit 890, he would be cast in gold and sent to Cooperstown. And this is the batting record for Iron Dome in this war. But preferably, we would maintain a deterrent equation, which is based on our capability to do them harm, reducing their capability to do us harm, reducing their political motivation, and sustaining a level of governance on the other side that enables them to make rational decisions.
Thank you.
Listen, thank you very much, Dr. Lehrman. That was informative. I hope that, and I know it's got this entire project off to a great start. And on behalf of all of us at YPO and WPO and the Global Forum, we'd love to thank you very much. I also want to remind people that the podcast of this call will be available within an hour after this call has ended. Importantly, we have another call set up, the second of the 5-part series. It's going to be on August 11th, and the topic will be, now that the negotiations are over, Iran and the P1, either P3+3 or P5+1, have agreed on terms, although the Americans have not agreed yet officially. Dr. Hans Jacob Schindler, a world-renowned expert in Iran affairs and sanction regime, will walk us through the history of the negotiations. What does the agreement mean? What is expected in the near future? All through Iran's eyes and its point of view. So again, thank you very much. I hope all of you and more will join us on August 11th. And look forward to more of these calls. Dr. Lehrman, thank you very much, and this will end the call.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.